So our first speaker will be Jay Johnson, who's going to talk about Tolkien, the evolution of language, and death, and other stuff like that. So, you go.
Tolkien, the fall and the evolution of language, yes. Hello, and thanks for coming. I'm Jay Johnson. Let's just dive right in. A pop quiz will follow the lecture, though, so y'all be ready. Since you're here, I'm going to assume a basic knowledge of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. What some of you may not know is Tolkien spent years working out a detailed mythology for his fantasy series, and his son Christopher published it in 12 volumes as The History of Middle-earth. And buried in the 10th volume is this story, The Tale of Adonel. Because, you see, Tolkien had a problem. Elves were immortal, but humans die. So how do you explain that fact? And he set out to do that, even if only to explain it to himself. The answer is in The Tale of Adonel, as I said. It's his version of the fall of humanity. The story was told by a human to an elf in the early generations. And Adonel was a wise woman who preserved the legend and passed it along to other wise women until it was eventually written down. That aspect of the story could easily serve as transmission history of early Genesis. No surprise there. Tolkien was a philologist. That involves the study of language evolution and oral and written and historical sources. So basically, it's like a Venn diagram of literary criticism, textual criticism, history, and linguistics. He was also a devout Catholic. His published writings are full of religious imagery, so it really shouldn't come as any surprise that he would reimagine the story as a version of Adam and Eve in Genesis. Today I'll explore what he got right from my perspective, from his training and intuition, and also cover what we've learned in the 75 years since he was writing. So, the story, the beginning. Some say the disaster happened at the beginning of the history of our people, before any had yet died. The voice had spoken to us, and we had listened. The voice said, "Ye are my children. I've sent you to dwell here. In time you will inherit the earth. But first you must be children and learn. Call on me and I will hear, for I'm watching over you." We understood the voice in our hearts, though we had no words yet. Then the desire for words awoke in us, and we began to make them. But we were few in the making worlds. We were few, and the world was wide and strange. Though we greatly desired to understand, learning was difficult, and the making of words was slow. So, taking it from the top, did Tolkien hold the young Earth creation interpretation that death, or at least human death, was unknown before the fall? No. Remember, he was inventing an explanation why elves were immortal and humans were not. So in his fictional world, he's constructing a fictional world. He's not describing his opinions about historical facts. Second, notice the difference between Tolkien's account and a literal interpretation of Genesis. The story doesn't begin with a single breeding pair, regardless of their names. It starts with the population, us and we. Tolkien understood biological evolution. From his own academic specialty, he also knew that languages, like species, change over time. And in his mythological world, hobbits died because they had descended from humans, mortal humans. So hobbits are basically evolved humans in his story. He was also writing when Pope Pius XII issued his 1950 encyclical on human origins, which said there was no conflict between Christianity and the theory of evolution, as long as God was the creator of each individual soul. That's Pius's. Based on these and other tidbits in his notes, the consensus is pretty much that Tolkien held some form of theistic evolution. Pope Francis is also a fan of Tolkien, for whatever that's worth. So let's review what comes next here. After this passage, goes on, "In that time we called often, and the voice answered. But it seldom answered our questions, saying only, first seek to find the answer for yourselves, for you will have joy in the finding, and so grow from childhood and become wise. Do not seek to leave childhood before your time. But we were in haste. We desired to order things to our will, and the shapes of many things that we wished to make awoke in our minds. Therefore, we spoke less and less to the voice. So now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. Tolkien is engaged in a thought experiment, okay? How could the fall have happened if it wasn't the result of the first two humans violating a specific command given to them directly by God? And evangelicals still struggle with this question today. Tolkien's answer was a blend of science and theology, as almost all of these things are. So taking the theology first, what jumps out to me is the voice of the Creator. We heard the voice that's spoken to us. The human desire for knowledge as well. We were in a hurry. Our minds came up with a lot of things. But the other thing is the image of the first children is the first humans is immature children. They're in a hurry to be adults, like all children are. Now, I'm not a concordist who looks for like a one-to-one correspondence between every statement of Scripture and historical reality, but I do believe in the inspiration of Scripture, so I'd like to think there's at least some point of contact between my faith and the facts of human history. For example, take a look at the curses pronounced upon Hadam, the man, and Ha'issa, the woman, following their transgression. Okay, all of these curses in Genesis 3 are anachronistic. It's basically an explanation, a mythological explanation. How do we get to now? How did we find ourselves in this situation? So, you know, the snake is sentenced to crawl on its belly. The woman will experience pain in childbirth and subordination to the man. The ground will produce thorns and thistles. The man will struggle for food and return to the dust from which he was made. So let's take stock. Death, weeds, and snakes existed before humanity ever appeared. We can all agree on that. Pain in childbirth has existed since humans first stood on 2 feet and evolved larger brains. Agriculture and patriarchy are recent inventions. So far, Genesis isn't really doing much better than Greek mythology. I hate to break the news to William Lane Craig, but this genre isn't mytho-historical. It's soundly in mythology, ancient Near Eastern mythology. So do God's curses on Hadam bear any relation to our situation today? And is there any point of contact between those curses and our reality? And I think absolutely yes. The main problem we face is spiritual, not physical. Blaise Pascal put it, if God exists, why doesn't he make it obvious? Why does God hide himself and leave us in darkness and obscurity, seeing hints of God but not proof, experience his absence as often, not more often than his presence? The one curse in Genesis 3 that is an anachronism is the spiritual punishment, humanity's expulsion from the garden. That was where we experienced the presence of God, and the disaster, as Tolkien put it, is, sorry, I lost my place. I apologize. This is what happens. Okay, there we go. So when I call, why does God seem so distant? You know, when I call, why doesn't he answer? You know, I used to sing that song in the garden in church. You've all heard that one, you know. He walks with me and he talks with me. I don't know. It sort of strikes me as psychotic now. Tolkien, like Pascal, attributed our individual and collective separation from God to an original disaster. Tolkien differed in offering an explanation that involved a population of humans drifting away from God and then prematurely declaring their independence from God. You know, that's much like an adolescent. You know, adolescents always want to be independent before they're ready. I said previously, I'm not a concordist, and there is no one-to-one match between early Genesis and human evolution, but there are points of contact between history and the Genesis narrative. I think Tolkien put his finger on the key questions when he focused on the making of words, the desire for knowledge, and the immaturity of the first humans. So now I'm going to turn to the science and give you that spiel. When did humans first speak? What light can the evolution of language shed on early Genesis? I mean, it's a tricky question because words don't fossilize, so we have to rely on other clues. Science places a great deal of weight on converging lines of evidence, so we'll start there. The physical requirements for speech begin with bipedalism. Walking on two legs allowed the larynx to descend, and it also relieved the thorax of its support while running. So when four-legged animals run, every time the front feet hit, the thorax braces, and then they pant. It's similar to a weightlifter lifting a bar, hold his breath when he heaves it up. So human speech would have been impossible if our Ardipithecus ramidus hadn't stood upright 4.5 million years ago. The next step involves a hyoid bone, which allows us to create vowel sounds. Ironically, it's known as the Adam's apple, and it's a free-floating bone that's really hard to find. They're rare because it's a free-floating bone, so in fossils, they don't find a hyoid very often. But not too long ago, they found some, and essentially what happens is the hyoid of primates has these little horns at the end of it that we lack. And Neanderthal has the exact same hyoid bone that we do, but Homo erectus has a hyoid that's intermediate between primates and humans. So about 1 million years ago was when that's about 1 million years ago. So speech is also impossible without controlling your diaphragm. We have to be able to control our breath to speak. A primate's spinal column is too narrow to hold the nerves to allow for control of the diaphragm. But Homo erectus from Dominici, Georgia, about 1 million years ago, had the spinal column large enough to hold those nerves. So, you know, did Homo erectus then speak language? Because they had some of, if not most of, the physical tools to be able to do it. And the answer to that is just no. There's a vast difference between a communication system, like bees can communicate, but they don't have language. Human language is at the opposite end of the spectrum there. Somewhere in the middle are chimps. Their vocalizations are inborn, but they have to learn the gestures that they use to communicate. These human children have to learn both. But their first communication efforts are gestures, point at what they want. You know, and then after that, you get single words, mama, dada, bottle. So when did languages we know it appear? So again, we need converging evidence because words don't fossilize. So linguist Sverker Johansson, he argues that language evolution followed a similar path to childhood language acquisition. So there's a one-word stage, and then there's a two-word stage. Then there's a simple sentence structure about, you know, two-year-olds start to give you sentences. Then there's flexibility, and finally, there's the full grammar of native language, which includes things like embedding and recursivity, or me being able to say something like, you know, I know that you're thinking, you know that I know that what you're, you know, that sort of thing. That's recursivity and embedding. And that's the features of fully modern language. So children acquire their native language by about the age of 5, but they don't grasp metaphoric thought or symbolism until like the age of 8 to 10. So the next line of converging evidence I want to highlight is trade networks, which are really fascinating. Because prior to 1 million years ago, resources for food and to make a stone tool came from about the same home range as chimps have today, about a 13-kilometer radius. That's about the distance you could walk out and back in one day. Okay, but then a million years ago, something strange happened. Stones to make a tool started to show up from like as far as 300 kilometers away. So, I mean, what happened? Did people suddenly start walking further? No. So this is something that it implies a trade network where you're trading with other people. So trade requires some form of communication, but also lessened aggression. Because, you know, if a chimp runs across a stranger in its territory, there's likely to be a fight. But humans, a million years ago, they did something different. They started to trade. And then another strange thing happened. Well, I missed a little bit there. But when the trade networks expanded again, about 100,000 years ago, to plus 300 kilometers, that's an important date to keep track of, because then about 35,000 years ago, trade networks expanded again to almost 1,000 kilometers. So what is happening here? That's just, you know, a little bit of converging evidence. So symbolic behaviors provide another line of converging evidence. And the evidence here roughly mirrors the dates that I outlined for trade networks. I mean, there's a few early, very disputed symbolic behavior, but what really starts to show up is about 100,000 years ago in Blumbo's cave, South Africa, where things like carved shell beads and clearly ochre for body paint and decoration. Graphic symbols carved on rocks in caves. And then about 40,000 years ago, the archaeological record, shows an explosion of representative art. These little things called Venus fertility figurines were all of a sudden everywhere. Oh, you're talking, you're kidding. How can that be 3-minute warning? He's a liar. So I'll skip ahead then. So the last piece of evidence is globularity. And that may not be familiar to y'all, but basically every previous hominin is born with a rounded brain. I mean, an elongated skull. But about 100,000 years ago, notice the date again, the human brain started to become more rounded, like my bald round skull back here. Now the things that the interesting thing too is, human babies are born with exactly that same skull shape, elongated like Neanderthals. But what happens in the first year of life is the parietal pole, the cerebellum, and start to expand, and it just reshapes the child's head into our familiar pattern. So notice again in these dates I've given you, 100,000 years keeps popping up, 30,000 years ago keeps popping up. It doesn't matter whether the subject is trade networks or other things that I mentioned. Sorry, I'm trying to hurry up, y'all. So to conclude, what was the nature of the fall of humanity? Tolkien related it to a gradual failure to listen to the voice of our Creator within our hearts, which is to say the voice of conscience. Conscience requires everything that I've spoken about here in terms of brain, language, and symbolic understanding. So, 1 minute, really? I'll jump to the end. Although the Western Church traditionally viewed the first humans as adults at their creation, the nature of their disobedience really better fits Irenaeus' concept of them as children. The fall in Genesis 2 and 3, it replicates transition from childhood to adulthood, to adolescence at least, because what's involved there is, The first thing that happens is the child begins to question the rules. Next thing that happens, they question the motives of the rule giver. And then finally, the child declares, you know, their own personal morality and takes control of the situation. And that's essentially what happened in Genesis. So ask me the right questions and I can finish off what I didn't get to cover. Oh, thank you.
Any questions?
They're stunned into silence.
Could you care to comment on Terence Deacon's book, The Co-Evolution of the Brain and Language? You know, as language became a little bit more complicated, the brain had to be more complex to interpret that language, and then we had bigger brains. We made more complex language, and so it was this cycle of
more
complex language, then bigger brains, and the bigger brains.
But it wasn't the size of the brain. It's the point of globularity. The globular brain, it really, like the first human in Jebel Erhoud, Morocco, 300,000 years ago, it has a small face like us, as opposed to Neanderthal has a large face. So it has a small face like us, but it doesn't have our brain case yet. It still has the same elongated brain case as Neanderthal. Mm-hmm. But starting about 100,000 years ago was when they found the first fossils with evidence of our rounded brain. And the process continued until about 30,000 years ago when all of those fossils are identical to our brain cases. Mm-hmm. The key there is the cerebellum is very wired into our language networks. And essentially, it was a rewiring of the human brain between 100,000 and 30,000 years ago. And the researcher who first outlined this stuff, he called it the language-ready brain. Mm. So it is the bigger brain, but it's not just a bigger brain. It's a brain that's been rewired so that all of it is better connected. Like Neanderthal was probably more like, they had a more modular type of brain in the sense of the two hemispheres didn't communicate so great. And the main thing that changed was that cerebellum. It's like Neanderthal, the closest we could come to that would be thinking that it's like when you're focused on something and you're really focused on something and somebody can speak to you, you don't even hear them sometimes because you're, and that's probably more what their mentality was like. They're focused. But you know, and their tool complex is too. The main thing about us is innovation and change.
Can we get to another question?
Yeah. Oh.
Thanks, I wasn't familiar with this work of Tolkien. So he seems to be saying that the capacity, so when we talk about human uniqueness, a couple of things come up. One is the capacity for transcendence, self-reflection.
Yeah.
The other is language, complex language. And he seems to be saying, perhaps you can clarify if evolutionary theory backs this up, I think he was saying that our capacity for transcendence precedes our capacity for the language. So this has a number of has implications for the possibility of salvation, relationship with God in non-verbal or pre-verbal humans, right? As well as it has implications, as you said, for the first humans, the development. Well, it would fit with Irenaeus' theory about human immaturity, et cetera.
I'm supposed to repeat the question, but I can't.
That's enough. So comments?
Yeah, comment on it. I think I would probably disagree, because I look at it again from the standpoint of a childhood development. You know, a child is not prepared to talk about God or trans. You know, it's got to be step one, step two, basics. But they're not really even capable of metaphoric thought until they get a little older. So, you know, here's a fun example for that is Santa Claus. Santa Claus is almost a test of that, you know. At what age do kids realize on their own without brother or sister telling them that Santa Claus isn't real? But the other aspect of that is that they realize at the same time that the person they trusted to give them this information may not always be reliable. And that's kind of exactly what Eve is going through in Genesis.
Right, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.